Welcome to the Ecology and Research Channel. Green issues, ecology, incredibly important to embodiment. Obviously, we're embodied in place, we're embodied in a world. How we treat ourselves is how we treat the planet and vice versa. So this is super important, I think, for our whole planet. Research relates to this. We've sort of put two together there. We didn't quite know where to put research, so we put them in with ecology. This stage has lots of great speakers, people I personally enjoy, and it's sponsored by Forests Without Frontiers. So rather than sell a sponsorship for this channel, we decided, you know what, let's give it away to a green charity. Tree planting seemed a good one. We thought we can all get behind that. We all breathe air. We looked into a load, actually. Some of them are quite famous, but don't actually plant a lot of trees, weirdly, or other things aren't so good with them. This one, Forests Without Frontiers, really does the work. They're in charge of a really big reforestation project in Central Europe, but, you know, we're all breathing it, thank you. It's run by Nicoletta, a very cool lady, and just a cool organization that really does the work. The money goes, you know, efficiently to actually planting trees. I'm happy to be supporting them. For me, it was like, you know, when we were looking at our charities to support, a green one just made a lot of sense to me. That just was obvious. Please do support them. Links below. As well as that, enjoy the whole channel. There's so much richness in this topic.
So for the next step, I would like to introduce you to the wonderful people which we have here on the webinar today, who will talk about embodied ways of knowing, which is Professor Shogo Tanaka. He's actually a professor of psychology and philosophy at Tokai University in Japan, and he received his PhD in philosophical psychology from Tokyo Institute of Technology. And he's primarily interested in phenomenology and psychology, and more specifically, clarifying the theoretical foundations of psychology from the perspective of embodiment, being inspired by the ideas of Maurice Merleau-Ponty. Then we have Professor Wei Wilcox, and she's actually born and raised in rapidly changing China, received her PhD in sociology in 2004 from the University of Minnesota. And since then, she has been teaching at St. Catherine University in dancing and researching with Ananya Dance Theatre, a Twin Cities-based dance company based that has built a transnational women of color feminist contemporary dance aesthetics. And then we have Dr. Kat Austin, who focuses in her artistic practice on environmental issues. She melds disciplines and media, creating sculptural and new media and still installations, performances, and participatory work. Dr. Kat Austin's practice is underpinned by extensive research and theory and driven by a motivation to explore how to move towards a more socially and environmentally just future. So we are so happy to have them on board for the panel Embodied Ways of Knowing. And this panel will be about, how do you recognize your friend in the street? How do I know how to ride a bike? How come some people have savoir-faire and others are clueless? How does intuition work? The short answer is embodied knowledge. Even though you've probably never heard of it, embodied knowledge underpins something like 95% of your thinking. So this panel brings together, you know, those wonderful scholars and also Dr. Adrian Harris, which is now with us on board. And Dr. Adrian Harris has been the wonderful person bringing all this together. So I'm really happy to have them all on board today. I'm going to hand over the work to Dr. Adrian Harris, who is going to also shortly introduce himself. Thank you so much.
Well, hi. This is a bit of a buzz for me, because when I first took this job on, what I really wanted to do was to bring together this panel. Shogo and I have been in touch for a long while talking about this, and then I did some research, found out about, is that right? And Shogo passed me on to Kat. And here we all are, experts in their field about embodied knowing, which is just so fundamental. So I'm gonna facilitate this conversation, but we'll step out for most of it because we haven't got a lot of time. So I want to crack straight on. So who would begin this exploration?
So it's Shogo beginning, then we have Dr. Kat Austin, and at last we have Dr. Huey Wilcox.
Okay, over to you, Shogo, for a bit of a an introduction to the whole, this whole strange and wonderful area. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. Can I start now? Okay. Let me share the screen, okay? Here the slide. Do you see it? Okay, thank you for your kind introduction. Well, first of all, I'd like to give thanks to the organizers who invited me to give a talk in this conference, especially to Dr. Adrian Harris, who organized this panel. Well, today, let me give you a very brief talk on the concept of embodied knowledge, which I am trying to develop based on the philosophy of Maurice Merleau-Ponty. Well, let's start by taking up some examples of human performances, okay? Please imagine a juggler who can toss and catch multiple balls very smoothly, or a tennis player who can run to the exact spot to return a ball, or a pianist who fluently plays a piece without any mistakes. Well, these skilled performances happen without deliberation, as if the body itself knows what to do in the moment. Well, although it is difficult for most of us to perform in such a sophisticated manner, we also encounter similar kinds of performance in our daily lives. Please consider the case of touch typing. Probably you are typing without visually confirming each letter on the keyboard. It happens in the manner that your body or your hands know how to touch type. This is the most basic aspect of embodied knowledge. That is, the body knows how to act in a given situation. Well, let me repeat. The body knows how to act in a given situation. Well, now, let me quote very well-known passages from Maurice Merleau-Ponty's text concerning the experience of typing. He writes as follows. It is a bit difficult, but please let me read it out. Quote, it is a question of the knowledge in our hands, which is only given through bodily effort and cannot be translated by an objective designation. The subject knows where the letters are on the keyboard, just as we know where one of our limb is, a knowledge of familiarity that does not provide us with a position in objective space. The movement of his fingers is not presented to the typist as a spatial trajectory that can be described, but merely as a certain modulation of motricity distinguished from every other through its physiognomy. Well, I think it sounds difficult, but these passages describe very well the fundamental features of embodied knowledge. Let me explain. They can be summarized in 3 points. Embodied knowledge is based on knowing how rather than knowing that. Knowing that is an information-based knowledge represented in propositions such as A is X or B is Y. In contrast, embodied knowledge is based on knowing how, which is training-based knowledge, such as how to swim, how to cook, how to play tennis, how to dance, and so on. Well, this type of knowledge cannot be reduced to a set of propositions, but is realized as a certain disposition for performance and expressed through skillful actions. Well, the second point, it is the body schema that underpins the function of embodied knowledge, which unfolds in an implicit or in a pre-deflective manner. Body schema is a system of sensory motor capacity that function without awareness or perception monitoring. One's body schema coordinates body parts into a unified movement and organize it as a concrete action in accordance with the environment. For example, when you lift a heavy object, you need to coordinate all the necessary movements into unified action. Bending the knees, or reaching the arms out, or grabbing the load, maintaining body balance, and so on. Well, the third point is affordance. What Merleau-Ponty calls physiognomy in the quoted passages is called affordance in the current context of psychology. Affordances are the action possibility that are latent in the environment and offer an individual the opportunity for particular actions. For example, if your body knows how to swim, you can perceive the water as something that invites you to swim. So embodied knowledge is not confined to the body, but embedded and extended into the environment. Well, probably most of you may know very well what the embodied knowledge is based on your own experiences. However, I'd like to draw your attention to the philosophical aspect of this knowledge. The concept of embodied knowledge will lead us to a relatively new view of the self. Well, before explaining it, please recall the classical view of the self that was proposed by René Descartes, the father of modern Western philosophy. Okay? Here I quote the most famous part of his discourse on the method. Well, needless to say, it is the part where he writes, "I think, therefore I am," right? And in the following part of the text, he continued that, "This I, that is, the soul by which I am what I am, is entirely distinct from the body, and indeed is easier to know than the body, and would not fail to be whatever it is, even if the body did not exist." Well, what is translated as soul here in this text would be better to understand it as mind in order to exclude the metaphysical meaning. Well, in any case, as you can see, this is the very idea against which this conference is all about. According to Descartes, the self is defined as a thinking subject and maintains its own identity even without a body, because thinking is the core function of the mind that is essentially independent from the body. The self is a cognitive capacity that could exist without a body. I think his view represents a purely disembodied view of the self. While in contrast, the embodied knowledge suggests an alternative view of the self. First of all, embodied knowledge implies that one's body has diverse dispositions for performance in correspondence to the environment. In relation to this point, Merleau-Ponty points out that the embodied view of the self is represented as "I can" instead of Cartesian "I think." In other words, the I equipped with embodied knowledge appears in the world as a subject who can perform various actions, mostly in an implicit manner. This view focuses on the implicit and pre-reflective aspect of the self rather than the reflective aspect. Well, let us take up an example of swimming to focus on the relationship between the self, body, and the world. Well, nobody is born knowing how to swim very well. First, one learns how to stay afloat in the water, which soon becomes a comfortable environment where the body can relax. And this renewed perception of water while floating enables one to learn how to push aside the water and move forward. And then further renewed perception of water during initial swimming enables one to continue to refine ways to move forward more effectively, and the process continues. And in this process of acquiring embodied knowledge, self-identity is never fixed nor defined by oneself internally through self-reflection of "I think." Rather, self-identity is flexible, fluid, and always changing by newly knowing how to interact with the environment. Well, okay, let me give a straightforward conclusion to my talk. In general, the concept of embodied knowledge defends the following ideas. First, a significant part of a knowledge is actually based on knowing how rather than knowing that. And integrating embodied knowledge into the traditional concept of knowledge is a very important task. Second, as a certain disposition for performance, newly developed embodied knowledge will bring a new mode of the self. In other words, it expands the horizon of "I can." For example, when you learn how to swim, you will enjoy the water as a new environment to which yourself extend into. Third, in contrast to Cartesian self, the self being based on embodied knowledge is skillful, ecological, and flexible due to the function of body schema. It is our body schema that opens up the endless dialogue between the self and the environment, or the self and the world. Okay, that's it from me. Thank you for your attention.
Brilliant. Thank you, Shogo, for a really lovely introduction to this whole topic. So next we've got Kat is going to come on and talk a little bit about how this relates to the perspective of artwork. So just to move swiftly on, we'll go straight over to Kat.
Thank you, Adrian. Yes, and thank you for having me here. It's a delight to be on this panel and to explore everyone's different perspectives on embodied knowledge. So let me just share my screen and I will, hang on. Yeah, okay. I'm gonna share this. Let me know if you can see my slides. Okay. So, are you able to see the slide? Okay, excellent. Thank you. Yes, jolly good. So, yes, I'm Kat Austin. I'm an artist, as we heard, and I'm going to be talking today about the approaches that I've been developing, which bring together diverse techniques and ways of knowing to create artworks and interventions that affect how we perceive what we commonly think of as ourselves in what we commonly think of as the environment. And I'll be discussing installations and artworks that work on the body to create an emotional connection to non-humans, and workshops where participants learn new techniques of how to investigate different environmental issues. So just to give you a bit of background, most of the time I exist in some liminality, but I have the honour to be anchored in a few institutions at the moment, which gives me the chance to work with some amazing people. And much of what I'm going to talk about today has been funded and facilitated by one or more of these affiliations. So, my artistic practice focuses on political and ecological topics. That's my main motivator. And my primary focus is the climate crisis and pervasive pollution. I've long been perplexed by the complex knot of knowledge, behavior, emotion, spirit, and politics that entwine to make the climate crisis such a wicked problem. We have plenty of data and reportage and an overwhelming scientific consensus, not only on the phenomenon, but also on our part in it. But we're not only reluctant to act, but seem to be incapable of it at an individual level, all the way up through to policy. So my question is, what more do we need to know? And crucially, how do we need to know it before we will act according to what we know? And this is where embodied knowledge really comes in, comes to the fore in my work. It's been argued that in order to tackle these wicked problems, we need new narratives to facilitate a new form of collectivity. And we can conceive of the collective, not only of a collective of humans, but of a collective of non-humans and more than humans in addition to humans. We're at a pivotal moment where collectivity, which is determined by our definition of the other and of nature, and the means by which we construct these, are in flux. In the context of acting collectively with human, non-human, and more than human others, the demarcation and delineation of the self, as well as the permeability of those boundaries around them, is particularly pivotal. In my artistic practice, I synthesize learning and knowledge-making practices from multiple disciplines, including chemistry, critical philosophy, phenomenology, and aesthetics, to interrogate various aspects of creating new knowledge and how this affects our relations to others in a complex and fluid ecosystem. I develop artistic and transdisciplinary methods through which to relate to the environment and relate to non-human and more than human others. Here you see images of DIY science experiments exploring the presence of boundary crossing microplastics in urban waters, along with recordings of the sounds of the river's waters and in the river's waters, ways of immersing oneself in the experience of another entity, in this case, a body of water. I juxtapose these methods with the subversion of the act of measurement, the codification of experience. Here you see me hacking electronics of scientific equipment that are used to measure chemical properties of water, properties which change with the consequences of the climate crisis and pollution. The hacking generates sounds, which allows you again to immerse through the subversive medium of measurement with the in contact with the water. From these researches, I develop artworks that explore relations that cross the border between the self and others. The Coral Empathy device pictured here is an installation piece that's an intense physical experience that combines smell with the vibrations felt through hearing and touch. It treats empathy as a vehicle by which we can traverse boundaries between the self and others. Alongside the obliteration of the visual, it evokes an emotional and empathic response in the wearer. The premise is to translate coral's experience of anthropogenic effects in its native environment of water into human perceivable signals in the native environment of humans, which is the air. I created the piece as a mode of conversation with a fascinating marine life form. I was struck by the physical properties of air versus water, one being a denser, wetter version of the other, and the fact that what is a joy and at the same time can be deadly to us, to marine life, is their natural environment. What could be more alien yet more relatable in this alien yet familiar landscape than coral? The device acts as a link between human in air and coral in water. But what's more than that, this conversation with coral is a way of exploring our own boundaries and the interconnectedness of existence. Our perceptions of ourselves change when we explore this, the permeability of the self. Just as we fail to engage with climate change when it happens on a scale too big for us to see, so we lose sight of our own permeability when it happens on too small a scale to observe, through our pores, our membranes, and incrementally through our emotions and through our history. One of the main concepts that shape my approach to the Coral Empathy device is that of embodied knowledge, which is the idea of doing without representing, Merleau-Ponty's notion that the body knows how to act. There is no need to verbalize or to represent in the mind of all the procedures required. The knowledge is imprinted in the body. The knowing subject here is the minded body or the embodied mind. This idea resonates with the decentralized nervous system of coral and other marine life, knowledge held not only in the brain, but in the rest of the body as well. For the Coral Empathy device, I actually drew on Shogo's work on intercorporeality in the human sphere, the idea that the body is a vehicle for our social cognition. My work leverages the fluidity of the distinction between the mind and the body, and the internal and the external. If our embodied interactions affect our notion of self and other, they can affect our empathy, our relation to the other, and thereby affect our relation to the environment. And this is true physically as well as philosophically. Membranes are permeable, skin is porous, and the substance of our being is in constant flux. For me, what we consider to be our bodies is in fact a flux and flow of matter and energy with multiple grades, which we perceive on different scales, giving us the perception of boundaries. It's a perspective that is also useful to apply to human body as it is to society and institutions that we have allowed ourselves to construct. This is a concept that I followed in order to create the work Vital Flows, a transdisciplinary participatory project that explores our experience of food. Food is a physical connection that we can easily perceive that shows the relationship between what we think of as inside our bodies and what we think of as outside. These methods are an exploration of transdisciplinary practice as a route to more integrated relationships between the self and others. It is the crossing of these diffuse boundaries physically and conceptually. It is seeing food as a conversation between ourselves and multiple facets in the environment, nature, nutrients, society, politics, and global systems. The project has two sides, a two-pronged approach. The first is Vital, which comprises these processes and which you can see here. The project has been delivered over 3 years as an undergraduate course at University College London, Bachelor's in Arts and Sciences, BASC, in collaboration with New Vic, a school in Newham, East London. We ran a series of workshops with the students and the pupils at the school, looking at cultural exchange, aesthetic eating, which draws on mindful eating, DIY chemistry, foraging, which is itself based on a lot of embodied knowledge in order to identify different edible plants, and forum theatre, which you'll see at the bottom right of the screen here, which also relies on bringing to the fore discussions that are expressed through embodied knowledge. So if you're not familiar with image theatre, it's a method of working through a script only with the body without speaking, where people assume different positions, and then in a round we explore what those different positions mean, what they show us of our basic assumptions about power dynamics in society. And with the image theatre techniques from Vital, we treat food as one of the actors in the image theatre. We also carry out collective co-creation, and I'd like to draw your attention here to some of the outputs of our 2017 students. Particularly on the bottom right, you'll see an interactive installation that looks at accessibility, the concept of accessibility of different foodstuffs, by leveraging the affordance of the sofa and the variable location of different foodstuffs. Finally, I left this slide in by accident, but how nice, after going through the workshops, that one of the new Vic students said, "I now connect with my food and experience it using all of my senses." So the other prong of Vital Flows is Flows, which is the artistic output that I create alone from the project. And I just wanted to introduce you to the sensual eating talismans, which are objects that one carries with oneself to evoke the kind of conscious concentration, the meditative aspect of aesthetic eating. So to connect with the embodied experience of eating and to connect with the concept of this flow of different matter that we take part in when we're eating. So finally, I'd like to introduce you briefly to another project, The Matter of the Soul, which follows on from the theoretical underpinnings of the choral empathy device, but which relies heavily on the conveyance of embodied experience through sound composition to engender empathy. The Matter of the Soul, which aims to engender empathy not just with another species, but with an entire ecosystem, in this case, the Arctic, under anthropogenic influence, is a multimedia installation that orients around a one-hour symphony that emotionally engages with the story of dispersal in the Arctic, dispersal of water as it turns from ice into seawater, dispersal of people as they move into and out of this rapidly changing and industrializing region. The Matter of the Soul is composed using recordings taken from the Arctic, from my various instruments, which you saw me hacking earlier, from snippets of interviews with people in the Arctic, and using traditional instruments. During performances of the symphony, I use my specially developed instruments to play water samples from the Arctic and from local water to highlight the global and local nature of the problem space, and to literally bring home the environment, environmental and emotional impact of the inherent loss woven into the changes reaped by the climate crisis and industrialization in the Arctic. Having immersed myself in the landscape of the Arctic through the research period of the work, I had a very distinct reaction to the topic in my body. I concentrated on these bodily feelings when composing the piece in order to convey them through sound to the audience. There was a part of my body that felt that it was torn open and full of a void when I was composing one of the movements. After one of the performances, an audience member approached me and told me she had had a very embodied reaction to the music, that she had felt a great gaping hole in her chest during the first movement, exactly where I had felt it when I was composing. It's an anecdote rather than something entirely proven, but it speaks to the role of I think the role of art and composition in working with the body and creating these relations through embodied knowledge as a mediator, one might say, for intercorporeality. So it just remains for me to say thank you to all of these institutions and individuals who have in some way contributed to the works that I've spoken about here today. And that's all from me. Thank you very much for your attention.
Lovely. Thank you, Kat. That was just beginning to give us some practical dimensions of this, which we're then going to go on to as Hui comes in and speaks about role of embodied knowing in the dance sphere. So without further ado, we'll go straight over to Hui.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me to this panel and to be in conversation with these amazing scholars and artists. So, all right. So my topic today is embodying the nation in Ethiopia. I'm acknowledging my collaborator, Malaku Balai here from Ethiopian Dance Association. Our questions are, how did dances in Ethiopia become Ethiopian dance? How did dancing bodies become symbols of the nation in Ethiopia? So I see how my research fits in this panel because my work has always been about dance as an embodied way of knowing, in the sense that analysis of dance leads to our understanding of very complex social and political processes. So a little bit of background, how did I come to this project? I grew up in China, always dreamt of dancing, but I didn't start dancing until I came to Minnesota, first with the Chinese American Dance Organization and then with the Nanya Dance Theater, which took me to Ethiopia in 2015. That's when I started doing research about Ethiopian dance, and one of the first performances I encountered was actually on the internet. It's called People to People Ethiopia. So this is a production made in 1987 by the socialist Derg government of Ethiopia at the time. And then it was toured globally to many countries. What I noticed was the aesthetic similarities between this production and a lot of the Chinese dance productions that I saw when I was a child growing up in China. So the format of evening length program composed of different ethnic dances and also choreographies that use unified movement and also linear or circular shapes. And then the use of nationalistic storytelling as an element of dance. So I want to go further deeper from the surface similarities to see if there's any connections, in the sense that dance and the fact that both China that I grew up with and then the Ethiopia that produced that dance production were both socialist regimes. So I want to explore the connection between dance and socialism or socialist nationalism. So I was inspired by work on Chinese dance and socialist legacy by Emily Wilcox, and then also the ongoing PhD research by Semenach and Beto Yohannes on Ethiopian music and socialist legacy. So I'm able to draw a preliminary conclusion that Ethiopian dance is indeed a modern construct, given that the nation has more than 80 different ethnic groups and they all have their unique movement traditions. But then, the question is, how do all these traditions come together to become a singular national category, Ethiopian dance? So in the research methods, I do a dance ethnography by observing performances, rehearsals, classes, and I interview both audiences and artists. So oral history has become an important method in constructing the narrative of dance and socialism in Ethiopia, partly because of the absence of written narrative as well. So it's clear now that the socialist regime in Ethiopia, actually is from 1974 to 1991, had a lot to do with the construction of this Ethiopian dance, what they actually call traditional Ethiopian dance. But it didn't actually initiate the project. Before the socialist regime, Ethiopia had an emperor, Emperor Haile Selassie, who was very interested in modernizing the nation. So he sent students abroad to study, and he brought in Western music and dance influences. And in 1964, he invited Hungarian researchers to research the indigenous dance types in Ethiopia. As you can, this is one of the pictures from their archive. Haile Selassie was also known for building state theaters, especially in the capital city of Addis Ababa. And when he was overthrown by the socialist regime in 1974, the socialist government inherited the theaters that he built and used them for socialist propaganda. At the same time, they also built local performance groups called Kinet. And so they actually devised a system of training dancers to know how to dance, right? And then, so these local dancers, locally trained dancers would become, some of them become really good, and they dance in national theaters. So they produced many weekly variety shows, both live and on TV. At the same time, they also conducted national dance research. They sent dancers, choreographers, costume designers to all over Ethiopia and bring back the indigenous dance forms and convert them to stage performances. So as a result, dancers at these national theaters, despite their own ethnic identities, they had to learn many different forms of ethnic dances. And they traveled all around the world to represent the nation of Ethiopia instead of their particular ethnic identity. And so People to People, the show that I first referenced, was one of the most memorable performances. And in a way, it is still shaping Ethiopians' imagination of what Ethiopian dance is, and in an embodied way, what Ethiopian nation should be. So the socialist government was ended in 1991, and the new government that replaced the socialist regime adopted a neoliberal approach to economy and governance. Part of the important part of it is to defund public infrastructure, including dance. So, as a result, dancers in Ethiopia are not very well paid. They don't have stable jobs, not respected as artists and professionals. And you also see gaping hole, absence of dance curriculum and dance schools in the formal educational system. But you still see a lot of dancing going on. This picture is, and this one are from a cultural tourist restaurants. So you see very lively music and dance performances, however, very much commercialized. You also see a lot of Ethiopian dance on YouTube clips. So I don't have a lot of time, but I want to draw a temporary tentative conclusion and also a little bit exploration of what dance as an embodied way of knowing mean in Ethiopia. So Ethiopian dance is definitely a national or even a nationalistic dance, and was molded and nourished by the socialist state, however malnourished in the neoliberal environment of privatization. And I'm making the case that dance in Ethiopia reflects the unique negotiation of modernity in Ethiopia, to the extent that Ethiopia is the only African nation that has not been colonized by European powers. You actually see very little influence of ballet training, very small, little traces of ballet training in all of the dancers in Ethiopia. But at the same time, Ethiopia and Ethiopian dancers still experience the consequences of colonization and neo-colonization, because they live under neoliberal conditions where there's disintegration of state and public support for the arts, and then dancers have to engage in individualized and market-driven competition for resources. But we see that artistic agency is still possible And we see dancers use dance movement as embodied way to understand their own society and to offer critique of these global forces, including neoliberalism and globalization. So I'm going to just end by showing an example of a dancer's critique of the government's intent to shut down an indigenous local market to build modern shopping malls that introduce external influences. And he's actually my research collaborator too. So I'm glad he's present here. And he's using very traditional Ethiopian movement to express the modern contemporary critique.
Thank you very much. So we now have had an introduction to the whole topic. Hui speaking about the dance perspective, Kat speaking about the artistic dimension. I'm just curious, just a question to the panel, is there anything that struck you hearing other people's thoughts? Is there a common theme coming up? There's some things I've got in mind, but just open question to you guys, anything there that struck you about what you've just heard from the others?
Yes, there was something that I...
You're muted.
Ah, yes. Sorry, there was a bit of muting, unmuting going on. Yes, one of the things that struck me while I was listening to Shogo and Hui talk was that there's the kind of the input, the embodied knowledge input, the body as the perceiving element. And then there's the expression through embodied knowledge. And what I would be really interested to know what my colleagues think about whether there's a tension there or whether these two things, it seems to me that there's a fluidity also between those two aspects, which is interesting when we think about embodied knowledge as a kind of a smoothing of these dualities that we've already talked about. That's one of the things that struck me. Hui is nodding a lot, so hopefully she's got something to say.
I mean, I was thinking a lot about the, a kind of a duality, I don't know if it's exactly the same as Kat was referring to, as the duality of knowing how and knowing that Shogo brought up in his presentation. As a dancer and as a dance researcher, like I can definitely see those two as very much intertwined, right? So the knowing how to move depends on your knowing that, right? That your body can move and also knowing that your society works in a certain way, either to marginalize or to celebrate your profession, your chosen profession of dance. So, and then, much of my research is really about dance as knowing how to move and then how it translates to understanding of our, knowing how do we know how our society operates in different contexts, obviously. So.
Yeah. And well, I would like to add some commentaries that, originally knowing that and knowing how was a distinction by the philosopher Gilbert Ryle, mm-hmm. who wrote it in his book titled Concept of the Mind. And he tried to understand once again, the mind on the basis of both knowledge. Mm-hmm. And he claimed that integrating both types of knowledge is a very important task. Mm-hmm. And actually, I saw Hui's presentation very interesting, which was showing integrating both types of knowledge in a kind of narrative practice. Mm-hmm. You showed that Ethiopian people who were involved in that project of dancing, they are trying to combine the narrative of being Ethiopian nation. Yes. and expressing it in a form of knowing how to dance. Mm-hmm. So the narrative was playing a very important role to combine both types of knowledge.
And the narrative becomes so embodied, right? And so much so that the body does, they do take on a different kind of identity. Their, you know, their notion of self changed in that process. I'm also very interested in Kat's notion of empathy, like in the empathy that's generated through embodied practices. It's, I'm sorry, did you not hear the sound of the dance clips?
No, well, I heard it.
Oh, okay.
It was quite low, but it was there.
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, because the sound is actually part of an important, very important part of that experience, because he's dancing in this local market with all the metal workers doing their work, right? So so they know how to do their work and he knows how to do his work. And the but juxtaposing those two different types of work together, you know, and that sound is, it's very, sounds very chaotic because it's just workers banging on their pots. But his movement is actually able to generate some rhythm. If you, you know, if you be in it enough, you will hear that he's dancing with the rhythm of the workers. So it's interesting that empathy, it's, you know, especially if you are in that environment, you, you feel the urgency of the work to make a living, you know, in the context of contemporary Ethiopia.
I actually had a question about that, if I may, just about the process and whether, because you said that he was using traditional dance movements to relate to this very new topic. And I wondered whether he'd noticed any changes in sort of the specifics of how he used those movements, or whether the mode by which he generated the movements was different when applying it to this new topic.
Yeah, very good question. I mean, you know, one, I didn't have time to show other clips of, you know, even People to People, the production that I that inspired this research, and also the restaurant, tourist restaurant dances that are pretty much, they pretty much inherited the socialist legacy in terms of their choreography and the modality of the movement. But so you see a lot of group choreography and, you know, people dancing in lines and, you know, mostly in lines. And then, but here, you know, obviously he's dancing solo. It's more individualistic. And then also he's not dancing on stage, right? So he's in the marketplace. This is completely real. Nothing is contrived. So, and he's dancing to very, you know, very much improvised soundscape as well. So, I mean, and he's also combining movements from different ethnic groups. So which is, might be a similarity to the national form, right? They put different ethnic dances on the stage in the same program, but he's moving a lot more fluidly. And in, I think in relation, you can see, you know, the nuances when he looks at the workers, and the workers sometimes will look at him. But they're both still immersed in their work. So I think, so definitely choreography wise, you know, how dance is, has to be shaped by the space that it's in. And he's not moving around that much, right? So he's confined in a way. And he's, you know, I think in a way to, he's respecting the workers, it's their space, right? And then he's there to witness their work and to express his own concern about the space survival. So yeah, very interesting.
I mean, there's a question, questions coming in for you. Robin asks, by pulling local indigenous dances into a national dance, does this affect the loss of local identity by being absorbed into the nation state? Are they getting lost in some way?
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, you know, I think that speaks to the vitality of the indigenous form in a way, right? So we actually have done some recent research, and we went to some of the smaller cities and see the dances. And right away, Malaku, and because he's more experienced in this form, and he said, yeah, I mean, these young dancers are imitating dancers in the capital city. Right, so there is definitely a process of encroaching of like, you know, which form is considered superior, right? Because it's also globalization. It's, you know, the dancers in these smaller towns, they actually see what dance is like in the capital city on YouTube, right? And then they think that's cooler. So that's more cool. So they would imitate them. So that may be a process of the indigenous dance might be encroached in some ways, but at the same time, you also see, I actually have so many clips, but I don't have time to show, like local people just doing their forms in their own way. So Malaku and other Ethiopian dancers recognize, well, they still have their own dance forms, and partly because the dances in these Ethiopian ethnic groups come from very deep embodied practices, right? So other kinds of embodied practices like religious ceremony. Their Orthodox church has a lot of movement in it, their, you know, church service rituals. And then also just, you know, weddings and even work, agricultural work, a lot of the movement is generated from that. So, and also I want to kind of deconstruct the binary too, the indigenous form. You know, if you ask the indigenous people, they might not think that it's completely separated from their national life or their contemporary life that's, you know, infiltrated by YouTube and TV and all of that. So, I don't know, does that make sense?
We're getting dangerously close to the end. It feels like we've only just started the conversation.
Yeah.
One of the things that we ask each of our presenters is to give us a top tip about how to be more embodied. I just invite you to give us a short little nugget of your thoughts on responses to that. Kat, do you want to start?
Sure. My immediate reaction is to go outside and put your hands in the earth and pay attention to what you feel.
Thank you. Shoga, have you got something to offer us? A thought about one top way to get more?
Yeah, well, listening to Kat and Fei's presentation, I have been thinking about, once again, what is the definition of the body? Because the body does not seem to have really the boundary. It goes beyond the boundary. So, well, once again, I have been thinking what the body is. Can I define it as something very individual or collectivistic, or it is very delineated or permeable or extended into the environment? Well, I have been thinking about, once again, what the body is and what the boundary of the body is. Thank you.
That's the question. Huey, over to you. Just a quick thought on getting more embodied.
Well, I think we are embodied by nature, right? So you have a body in the sense that, so the question is how to bring our embodiment into other spheres of work or life that we have, right? So whether it's activism that Kat is talking about or scholarship, right? Or teaching, you know, how do we bring embodiment into the classroom? And, you know, just to, I think I use image theater as well. And how do you break those boundaries? I mean, you know, the fact that you're in the classroom, you're just only supposed to be in your headspace. I mean, those boxes have to be broken, I think. Thank you.
That reminds me, we had a session the other day. I think it was Ronnie Zohar was talking about using embodied knowing to teach physics. It was extraordinary. So it's been a theme throughout this whole conference, and we're getting dangerously close to the end. Kath, do you want to bring us to a close?
Yeah.
Thank you all. That's been awesome.
I would like to thank everybody for this wonderful, panel. I so much richness. I almost cannot believe it, how much I can take home from this. So I would like to thank Professor Shogo Tanaka, Professor Hui Wilcox, and Dr. Kat Austin very, very much for joining us today. It was wonderful. And thank you so much, Adrian, for, you know, moderating this, and, you know, your presence made it even richer.